The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
This week, a conversation about impeachment. We try to learn all about it with constitutional scholar Kim Whaley.
This is really about Congress acting on behalf of the American populace to ensure that their elected officials are functioning for them and not for their own self-interest.
Politics, policy, and a side of pop culture. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The impeachment inquiry targeting the State Department.
The former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine arrived on Capitol Hill for a closed-door deposition.
Later, charting a new atlas.
Our mission is to help people find the sort of hidden wonders all over the world.
And now, from the Capital One Bank Studios in the CBS News Washington Bureau, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Let's start this weekend on Capitol Hill. That's where House Democrats heard from the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine in their impeachment inquiry.
Marie Yovanovitch, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, arrived on Capitol Hill for a closed-door deposition. Yovanovitch was recalled to Washington in May after the president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, claimed that she was blocking his efforts to get Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Her name also came up in President Trump's July 25th call with the president of Ukraine. Mr. Trump said Yovanovitch was bad news and that she was going to go through some things.
I heard very, very bad things about her for a long period of time. Not good.
Two foreign-born men with ties to President Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, appeared in court on campaign finance violations. Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman are accused of illegally funneling foreign donations to political campaigns, including $325,000 to a pro-Trump super PAC.
I don't know those gentlemen. Now, it's possible I have a picture with them because I have a picture with everybody.
The indictment alleges Parnas and Fruman also met with congressional members here on Capitol Hill in an attempt to have Ambassador Yovanovitch ousted from her job.
See you in Ukraine soon.
The pair also helped arrange meetings in Ukraine for Giuliani and were seen dining with him at Trump's hotel shortly before they were arrested.
They were about to board an international flight with one-way tickets.
Monday, lawmakers are expected to hear from Fiona Hill, the former Russia policy expert on the National Security Council. She's expected to testify that Giuliani and European Union Ambassador Gordon Sondland actively avoided the NSC process while working on Ukraine policies. Bofta Yimam, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
Former Vice President Joe Biden is upping his attacks against President Trump on the campaign trail.
To preserve our Constitution, our democracy, our basic integrity, he should be impeached.
After hedging on impeachment for weeks, Joe Biden ripped into President Trump, calling him a threat to every American.
We all laughed when he said he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and get away with it. It's no joke. He's shooting holes in the Constitution, and we cannot let him get away with it.
The president responded during Biden's speech, tweeting, Joe's failing campaign gave him no other choice.
You know, he didn't say that until right now, and he sees what's happening to him. I guess he's no longer the front runner.
Biden told CBS station WBZ that he did nothing wrong as vice president while his son Hunter served on the board of a Ukrainian energy company.
I don't discuss things with my son or my family because I don't want to have any knowledge of any. I don't want to be accused of, well, you talk with your son or you talk with your whomever.
Biden has been reluctant to get into specifics on Ukraine, leaving some voters with doubts.
I think there's been a lot of questions lately about that I want answered from him about Hunter and, you know, just a lot of the kind of rumors that are going out there.
Recent national polls suggest Biden hasn't lost supporters over the charges. But since the summer, he has seen his frontrunner status challenged, including here in New Hampshire, where he's neck and neck with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
The Biden campaign says the former vice president changed his mind on impeachment in part because of the president's refusal to cooperate with Congress. He is now the last of the 19 Democratic presidential candidates to support impeaching President Trump. Ed O'Keefe, CBS News, Manchester, New Hampshire.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is stepping up pressure on President Trump to return the wife of an American diplomat to the UK after she was accused of killing a man in a crash.
It was an accident. It was a terrible accident.
President Trump says his administration will speak to the wife of a U.S. diplomat who fled the U.K. after a car crash that killed a 19-year-old British boy.
So Harry would have come down this road up here.
Harry Dunn died when his motorcycle collided with an SUV on a country road in England back in August.
Where the flowers are still there, look. Oh, my Lord, they're still...
American Ann Sekulis was allegedly behind the wheel and reportedly driving on the wrong side of the road.
And that can happen. You know, those are the opposite roads. That happens. I won't say it ever happened to me, but it did.
President Trump didn't say whether the U.S. will revoke Sekulis' diplomatic immunity and send her back to the U.K. to face trial.
The victim's family is planning to travel to the U.S. to pressure the Trump administration to put the wife of the U.S. diplomat on a plane back to Britain.
Everybody else in the world can see what she's done is wrong. Why can't they see that?
Dunn's mother called the president's words throwaway comments and said U.S. and British leaders have failed to give justice to her son.
Just disgusted, let down by both governments.
The family is considering legal action, which could include suing the American government for damages. Cindy Palm, CBS News, London.
A fight over whether a federal law protects gay and transgender people at work is in the hands of the Supreme Court after justices heard arguments Tuesday. More from correspondent Jan Crawford.
I was fired for being gay.
Gerald Bostock says he lost his job in Georgia after joining a gay recreational softball league.
It's a much bigger issue than just me.
Transgender woman Amy Stevens said she was fired from a Michigan funeral home after she revealed she was transitioning from a man.
And we all deserve the same rights.
They asked the court to rule that Title VII of the 1964 Federal Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination based on an individual's race, color, religion, sex, or national origin, also protects employees based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. But conservative justices suggested those arguments should be directed instead at Congress. Justice Samuel Alito, the point is that discrimination on the basis of sex, in the sense that Congress understood it in 1964, is a different concept from discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation.
Justices noted far-reaching implications, same-sex bathrooms, dress codes, and transgender women playing on women's sports teams.
Congress repeatedly has refused to change the 1964 law to specifically prohibit employment discrimination based on sexual orientation. And until last year, federal appeals courts have uniformly said it wasn't covered, leading 22 states and the District of Columbia to pass their own laws outlawing it. But liberal justices were sympathetic, saying the civil rights law was aimed at combating discrimination, even if not seen as a problem at the time. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Title VII was meant to strike out the entire spectrum of sex stereotyping.
Now, the court's two new justices seemed almost impossible to predict. I mean, Justice Neil Gorsuch did seem somewhat open to the idea that the words of this law could be read to cover this kind of discrimination. But then he seemed concerned about the, quote, massive social upheaval that kind of ruling might cause. Jan Crawford, CBS News, the Supreme Court.
Coming up, tensions rise in northern Syria as Turkey attacks Kurds. That's next on the Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Turkey says it's stepping up its attacks on Kurdish U.S. allies in northern Syria as President Trump says he's pulling American troops out of the region.
Smoke billowed over a Syrian border town Friday as Turkey stepped up its offensive against Kurdish forces in northeast Syria. A nearby explosion interrupted this reporter's interview with a local resident. The violence in the town sparked a mass exodus. The head of the UN Refugee Agency called the situation a deepening humanitarian crisis.
Over the last 48 hours, tens of thousands of people have been fleeing their homes as a result of the escalation of conflict in northern Syria. And hundreds of thousands more are at grave risk.
On the Turkish side of the border, mourners attended a funeral for a 9-month-old Syrian baby killed in a mortar attack fired from Syria. Turkey's invasion came after President Trump pulled American troops from the area. The withdrawal left the Kurds, a key U.S. ally in the fight against ISIS, vulnerable to Turkey, who considers them terrorists.
We want to fight
where it is to the benefit of the United States of America, not to the benefit of other countries.
The president is suggesting other ways to help resolve the conflict that do not involve the U.S. military.
We could hit Turkey very hard financially, or we could mediate a deal between Turkey and the Kurds. I like that. You know, let's mediate a deal.
Kurdish forces have been holding thousands of captured ISIS members in Syrian prisons. World leaders are concerned the invasion could lead to their release. Nicole Killian, CBS News, the White House.
A sacred day for Jews interrupted with an attack in Germany.
I think the Holocaust never happened.
The suspect broadcast his rampage live online, showing off his weapons and ammunition in a car before turning his gun on a woman walking by. The shooter then tries to break and shoot his way into a synagogue, but the door doesn't open. Inside, dozens of worshippers were observing Judaism's holiest holiday, Yom Kippur. Rebecca Blady, who moved from New York to Berlin earlier this year, was one of them.
And they told us, get out of here, go in deeper into the synagogue building, go upstairs.
Police say when the shooter couldn't get into the synagogue, he entered a nearby kebab shop and killed a man. Hours later, they arrested the suspect seen in the live stream video, a German man identified by local media as 27-year-old Stefan Ballett.
It was really terrifying and spiritually also a very deep experience.
Correspondent Roxana Saberi reporting from Halle, Germany. Meanwhile, peace is being celebrated by the Nobel Committee. It selected Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed Ali as this year's Nobel Peace Prize recipient. Here's CBS News foreign affairs analyst Pam Falk.
The Ethiopian leader was awarded the Peace Prize in recognition of his role in ending Ethiopia's border conflict with Eritrea that spanned two decades and for the reforms he launched despite protests and unrest, known widely in the region as Abomania, for growing the economy. And the Norwegian sponsors of the prize noted his efforts for peace pacts in other countries in Africa.
Back home, more than 1,000 Los Angeles firefighters are being deployed to battle a raging fire throughout Southern California. More from CBS News correspondent Mark Liverman.
Extreme winds and hot, dry weather have caused multiple fires across Southern California. As crews in Sylmar worked to fight back the flames of the Saddle Ridge fire, others led horses away from the danger. Other areas like Calamasa continued to face the dangers of the Sandalwood fire late Thursday night.
It was a trash truck that was carrying a load that caught on fire.
Several hours after that fire started, dozens of homes were destroyed.
The wind was so intense that it just engulfed the whole park. It was so fast, there was just no way.
50 miles east of Los Angeles in Fontana, homes were burning just as the power company shut off electricity in the area to prevent new fires from popping up.
I was coming down the street, and I saw a lot of smoke coming out.
Southern California Edison warned that thousands more could lose service as the Santa Ana winds continue to gain strength.
It just shows us that I guess we were not prepared. We're charging the phones in the car to at least have that. We had a couple of flashlights and hopefully it will come back on.
In the northern part of the state, utility company PG&E faced criticism from residents and California's governor after it shut down power to hundreds of thousands of customers.
We simply could not continue to run parts of this system given the risk to public safety.
Residents say PG&E's system should have been improved to avoid these types of blackouts. Mark Liverman, CBS News.
Now to the Florida Panhandle, where parts of the area are still trying to clean up from Hurricane Michael a year ago. Here's correspondent Manuel Bojorquez.
The Category 5 hurricane barreled into Mexico Beach, Florida last October. A year later, reminders of the deadly storm are everywhere.
So a year ago, this looked exactly the same.
That has not changed. Nothing.
Al Caffey runs the local hardware store and has been mayor here for 15 years.
You know, when 75% of your city is destroyed, things aren't going to happen quickly in a year.
There is clearly progress, but people here say insurance payouts have been slow, and dealing with government red tape is frustrating. 1,200 lived here before the storm. Now, it's just around 400.
It's been a lot of lows in the very beginning. The last 6 months, we, you know, got a little click in our heels.
But in nearby Panama City, hundreds still live in FEMA trailer parks. More than 2,400 Bay District school kids are listed as displaced or homeless. And Tyndall Air Force Base, a major employer, has spent $700 million on repairs, but still has more to do.
How's that cold beer today?
Trudy White and her husband relocated to Florida after losing everything in Hurricane Katrina. Their Cajun restaurant on Panama City Beach avoided a direct hit from Michael, but many of her employees weren't so lucky.
What has been the biggest hurdle to recovery here?
Keeping the employees. A lot of people lost their homes in town and they had to move away because they didn't have any place to live. The people who were able to stay, looking for a new place to live, the rent went sky high for everybody.
Back on Mexico Beach, Jessica Schwark is general manager at Mango Marley's, which is still operating out of a food truck. But she says the tide here has begun to turn.
When I would see people at first, we would cry and hug. And it's still nice to see them, but it's a little more normal. You know, we're it's sad, but this is kind of just our new normal. You know, it's
this
just,
is the new normal.
Yeah. Most days we don't even think about the hurricane, really.
Despite some progress here, there is clearly a long way to go. Before Hurricane Michael, between apartments, houses, and condos, there were 2,700 units here. Now, barely 500 of those are livable. Manuel Bojorquez, CBS News, Mexico Beach, Florida.
Up next, former TV anchor Matt Lauer responds to a new sexual assault allegation.
Former Today Show host Matt Lauer, in a public letter, stated his silence has been a mistake.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Crime. Justice. Impact.
Are you making this up?
Nope. Stories that change lives.
I take no pleasure having to interview with 48 Hours about this.
Get a clue. 48 Hours, Saturdays on CBS.
From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Former NBC Today Show anchor Matt Lauer, who was fired after being accused of sexual misconduct, is now battling a new allegation of rape.
In a fiery response to the rape allegation against him, former Today Show host Matt Lauer, in a public letter, stated his silence has been a mistake, writing, "For 2 years, the women with whom I had extramarital relationships have abandoned shared responsibility and instead shielded themselves from blame behind false allegations." Lauer directed most of his sharp denials of the sexual misconduct allegations against him toward Brooke Nevels, who told Ronan Farrow in his new book Catch and Kill that the former NBC anchor raped her in his hotel room during the Sochi Olympics in 2014. Lauer writes, "There was absolutely nothing aggressive about that encounter. She was a fully enthusiastic and willing partner. At no time did she behave in a way that made it appear she was incapable of consent." In a statement to NBC News on Wednesday, Nevels called Lauer's open letter an attempt to bully a former colleague into silence. She says, "I am not afraid of him now, regardless of his threats and the shaming and predatory tactics." In Catch and Kill, Farrell also writes he uncovered 7 allegations of workplace sexual misconduct against Lauer predating his November 2017 firing. In a memo to employees, NBC News Chairman Andy Lack says any suggestion executives knew of allegations against Lauer before his firing are absolutely false and offensive. In a statement, NBC called Lauer's conduct appalling, horrific, and reprehensible, adding he was fired within 24 hours of us first learning of the complaint from Nevels. Farrell also reveals new accusations involving disgraced Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein. Farrell claims Weinstein used Lauer as leverage to suppress stories about himself and made it known to the network that he was aware of Lauer's behavior and capable of revealing it. Farrell eventually took the Weinstein story to The New Yorker. In his memo, Lack defended the network's handling of the Weinstein story, saying Farrell simply didn't have a story that met our standard for broadcast.
That was correspondent Jerika Duncan reporting from New York. STD rates continue to grow.
Infections from three sexually transmitted diseases have increased for the fifth straight year. Reported cases of chlamydia jumped by 3% last year compared to the year before. The gonorrhea rate was up 5% to about 580,000 cases. And the syphilis rate was up a whopping 15% to about 35,000 cases, the most since 1991. Officials say the increases coincided with public health funding cuts and clinic closures. Jim Shenavy, CBS News.
E-cigarettes are threatening more than just your health, according to CBS News transportation correspondent Chris Van Cleve.
Spare lithium-ion batteries sparked this fire in February aboard a Delta flight while it sat at the gate. Those batteries are in e-cigarettes like this one that went up in flames in the TSA line at Charleston, West Virginia's airport. And here, another fire at the airport in Savannah, Georgia last year. A quick-thinking TSA officer removed a smoking bag from security. The cause? The battery for a vape pen. FAA reports from 1991 through this August show at least 48 e-cigarette-related smoke or fire incidents at airports or on planes. That's more than laptops and tablets, cell phones, battery chargers, or spare batteries. If a battery fails and enters what's called thermal runaway, it can burn so hot the plane's fire suppression system can't put it out.
A lithium-ion battery fire on a plane can be catastrophic.
Sarah Nelson, the president of the Association of Flight Attendants, says flight attendants have become firefighters on planes, and the FAA needs to do more.
How about we just not have these e-cigarettes on the plane at all?
But Mark Millam from the Flight Safety Foundation says while batteries from e-cigarettes are a great concern on planes, more information is still needed before an outright ban makes sense.
A ban could happen when there's the right information that's understood about it.
And those lithium-ion batteries are in pretty much all of our mobile devices. The FAA tells CBS News in a statement it has clear regulations on the safe transport of lithium-ion batteries. E-cigarettes, vape pens, and spare batteries must be transported in carry-on bags only. The agency adds, because of the wide variety of battery issues that can occur, it's important that airlines have the flexibility to assess and address the risks involved in each individual situation. The inventors of the lithium-ion battery were just awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Chris Van Cleve, CBS News, Reagan National Airport, Virginia.
A passenger mutiny on board a cruise ship. Correspondent Mola Lenghi explains.
We were very, very disappointed, and we were not alone.
Passengers leaving the Norwegian Spirit cruise ship were quick to share their anger.
There's a lot of people that are saying never again.
Yeah, we feel like we've been scammed.
The cruise left from the same port in England on September 27th. Passengers paid prices starting around $1,200 for a 14-day trip that was supposed to include stops in Holland, Norway, Iceland, and Ireland.
We don't want to be on the ship!
We want off the ship!
But problems mounted quickly after what Norwegian called severe weather conditions. Within the guidelines of its guest contract, the ship canceled several planned destinations, leaving irate passengers stuck on board for days.
The toilet just does not flush.
The hallways didn't smell very good. Smelled like sewage.
Katasha Jones and her boyfriend left the cruise early amid additional concerns over broken plumbing. She says Norwegian's response leaves a bad taste.
A refund would be nice, but a discount to spend more money with them is really just not going to cut it for people.
Mola Lenghi, CBS News, New York.
A milestone for African-American filmmakers. Here's CBS's Meg Oliver.
Tyler Perry is the first African-American to independently own a major film studio. It's the largest film complex in the country, bigger than the Burbank, California lots owned by Warner Brothers, Paramount, and Walt Disney Studios combined. He spoke with CBS This Morning's Gail King.
The New York Times said, "You are the most successful mogul Hollywood has ever ignored. Do you think Hollywood gets you?"
No. I clearly believe that I'm ignored in Hollywood for sure, and that's fine. I get it.
Wait a second. Is that fine?
It is. My audience and the stories that I tell are African-American stories that I grew up with, and we speak a language. Hollywood doesn't necessarily speak the language.
Who doing your hair?
But Perry's Madea films have had universal appeal, and he hopes to build on his success. Rodney Ho has covered entertainment in Atlanta for decades.
Is this considered the next Delta Airlines or Coca-Cola for Atlanta?
When people bring up Atlanta, you'll think of CNN and Ted Turner, you'll think of Hank Aaron and the Braves, and
Coca-Cola and you'll think of Tyler Perry.
The studio is built on a former Confederate Army base. That irony is not lost on Perry, who named each of the studios after prominent African Americans in the film industry. Meg Oliver, CBS News, New York.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, a unique look at the world.
We are a compendium of the world's wondrous and curious places.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
I'm a self-admitted Atlas nerd. I love checking out the far-flung places that seem a world away from me. And one of my favorites is Atlas Obscura, an easy way to kill a couple hours. Joshua Four helped create the website turned book, now in its second edition, and he joins me on the line from Boston. Hi, Joshua.
Hi. Great to be here.
For folks who've never read Atlas Obscura, can you describe what it is?
We are a compendium of the world's wondrous and curious places.
That's a lot to describe yourself as. I mean, what exactly is that?
Okay, so our mission is to help people find the sort of hidden wonders all over the world, that the kinds of places that make you stand up and go, wow, I can't believe I share planet Earth with this incredible thing. And we started this with a crowdsourced website where people could share their knowledge about these kinds of, you know, hidden wonders. 10 years later, we have 18,000 plus places in the database, and now this great encyclopedic book, which is the very best of Atlas Obscura from all over the world.
And that's a lot to choose favorites from, but what would some of those places be that stand out to you?
Oh my gosh. It's like asking to choose your favorite children. Well, I will tell you that the place that I have most longed to visit from Atlas Obscura is a place called the Gates of Hell in Turkmenistan. And it is this gigantic flaming hole in the ground that looks like some kind of a volcanic crater, but it was actually created 40 plus years ago as the result of a Soviet industrial mining accident. So the story is the Soviet miners accidentally punched a hole in the desert and landed in a cavern of methane, which began belching into the atmosphere. They set this place on fire, thinking that they would burn off the methane in a couple hours, a couple days. The fire has been going for 40 years, and it's just this, you know, illuminated, mysterious opening in the earth that the locals call the Gates of Hell.
How many of these places have you guys been able to visit?
Well, if you're asking about us as the authors of the book, I think, you know, one of the fun things about the website is you can, when you see a place you've been to, you can click I've been there. So I've been to almost 500. I think Dylan has been to a little bit more than 500 of the places in Atlas Obscura. But I will say,
and Dylan is your co-author.
Yeah, he's the co-founder and co-author of the book. And I will tell you that when we started this project and we first learned about the Gates of Hell in Turkmenistan, we said, you know, one day we should really go there. And lo and behold, one of the things that we started doing at Atlas Obscura is offering international trips. And this March, Dylan and I are going to go with 12 readers of Atlas Obscura on a trip to the Gates of Hell in Turkmenistan. So that is one that we will finally be able to tick off of our list.
Let me ask you why you got interested in starting this whole project to begin with.
You know, I think it was born, for me at least, out of a trip that I took when I was 20 years old. Around the United States, I rented an old minivan and bought an old minivan, and drove it all around for about 8 weeks. And my mission was essentially to have an adventure every day. And I was looking for a resource that would help me do that, that would help me find hidden corners of this country. And I realized there was nothing really great out there that met my needs, the kind of way that I wanted to see the world and experience the world. And Dylan, my co-founder, had a similar experience traveling all over Eastern Europe. And we said, you know, why don't we just create this? And it began really as like an art project. Like, let's get people from all over the world to help us catalog the world's hidden wonders. And it's just grown and grown and grown from there. And now it's this global community. We've had something like 600,000 people contribute to the building of this atlas of the world's wonders.
Are there any qualifications that a place has to meet to be in the Atlas Obscura?
It has to be Atlas-y. I know that's circular, But it's like a you know it when you see it kind of thing. And one of the things that has been so satisfying about this project is people generally really get it. Like they know when something is a kind of Atlas-y spot. Like the Eiffel Tower could never be in Atlas Obscura, but there is at the top of the Eiffel Tower this secret room that Gustav Eiffel built to entertain guests. And it tends to be the case that even when you're looking at like places like the Eiffel Tower, there is an Atlas lens you can apply and find the thing that is wondrous, curious, hidden.
Atlas Obscura author Joshua Four on the Weekend Roundup. In expanding effort to cut short work weeks, reports CBS's Kenneth Craig.
Andrew Culbertson is a digital marketing coordinator for an Indiana company. Even though he works full-time, you won't find him in the office on Fridays. Employees have the option of working four 10-hour days.
It's wonderful.
CEO Bernie Veldman says offering the four-day option has helped him attract new workers.
People like having Friday off. And, you know, I find myself that, you know, by the time Saturday rolls around, all the stuff I wanted to get done is already done on Friday, and you really get more of your weekend to enjoy.
A report out last year found 27% of companies offer compressed work weeks with four 10-hour days. 12% go a step further and offer 4 days, but employees only have to work 32 hours a week.
This four-day work week is something that we're starting to see as a trend.
Dawn Fay with the Robert Half Staffing Agency says the tight job market has companies creating perks like flexible hours, the ability to work from home, and even unlimited vacation.
So there's a lot of different things that we're seeing out there that's helping companies try to attract and retain and keep employees from burning out.
Culbertson says the four-day week has boosted morale.
Even if you have a rough Monday morning, you know, 4 days from now, I have a long break.
He can always look forward to a three-day weekend. Kenneth Craig, CBS News, New York.
A new frontier for Sesame Street.
Sesame Street is looking at the backstory of Carly. She's a bright green friend of the Muppet Elmo's, whose mom is fighting addiction. In the online-only segments, Carly is joined by Salia, a 10-year-old whose parents are in recovery. Carly tells her, "I've met so many other kids like us. It makes me feel like we're not alone." Sesame Street creators say they wanted to deal with addiction because data shows that 5.7 million children under the age of 11 live in homes where a parent has a substance abuse disorder. Allison Keyes, CBS News.
Now to a legal battle involving another children's show.
It's a familiar tune from holiday TV specials. The Charlie Brown Christmas theme song is the subject of a battle between its copyright owners and Dollywood. The complaint says the Tennessee theme park, named for Dolly Parton, has used the song without permission for live Christmas shows since 2007. Lee Mendelson Film Productions is asking for $150,000 for every time the song's been used. Dollywood declined comment. Pam Coulter, CBS News.
Coming up, Ellen speaks out about her friendship with a former president.
I'm friends with George Bush. In fact, I'm friends with a lot of people who don't share the same beliefs that I have.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Sunday morning on CBS.
Good morning. I'm Jane Pauley.
Experience thought-provoking, innovative.
Look through a telescope and go, wow.
And truly original reporting on CBS Sunday morning.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
This weekend on 48 Hours, CBS's David Begno hears from the survivors of the 1976 Chowchilla kidnapping after their convicted captor faced a parole board. David joins us from New York. Hi, David.
Hi, Steve. So there were three convicted captors. Two have been released. This guy who went before the parole board was denied parole for the 16th time.
So these 26 school children who were held hostage on their way back from school in Chowchilla, California, have been living with this for decades, reminded each time this man comes up for parole. Remind us what happened.
Well, so, all right, it's 1976. You got more than 20 kids on a school bus with the driver. They are going down a rural road in the middle of nowhere, and there's a car that looks like it's broken down. The bus goes to kind of weave around the vehicle. Next thing you know, three guys with stockings over their head and weapons take the kids and the driver captive. And the saga of what happens over the next 18 hours, I mean, is something that it's almost too hard to believe. I've been covering news for 20 years, and if someone said this happened, I'd say, okay, seems a little hard to believe. But they literally vanished without a trace until their bus was found in an agricultural field and until they came walking out of a hole in a rock quarry outside of San Francisco in the rural area. And a group of people at the rock quarry looked at them and said, where are y'all from? And they said, we're lost. We're from Chowchilla. And that's how the story that gripped the nation, led the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite for several nights in a row, captivated the White House. Literally everybody was focused on where are these children, and they'd been buried alive.
What was it like to hear from these survivors about their experiences during this really traumatic time, especially, as you said, buried alive?
I wasn't expecting the trauma to be so raw today. It's been more than 40 years, but the pain, when they reflect on the memories, is still as raw and real as arguably it was back then. And in the hour, you'll hear one of the ways they tried to process the grief or the trauma of what happened with the kids. And it'll kind of make you go, you're kidding me, right? Because today, kids who went through such an ordeal would likely go to therapy or something different, right? But you'll find out where they were sent, and it will surprise you. There is a very... I would call it fulfilling, if that's the right word, a fulfilling part of the hour at the end where you really come away understanding what these people have gone through, right? They survived. Nobody was killed. The bad guys went to jail. But these people have literally spent the rest of their lives trying to stay on track. And every time there's been a parole hearing, every time, they've had to relive what happened, either because they testified at the parole hearing or they sat by the phone waiting to find out if said individual was going to get released.
Do we know, all these years later, exactly why this all happened?
Well, so that's one of the most interesting things. And I'm going to read the quote to you because it's hard to believe. One of the kidnappers said this. The reason they did it is because, quote, we needed multiple victims to get multiple millions, and we picked children because children are precious. These were guys who came from wealthy families, lived in wealthy suburbs outside San Francisco. Their parents were wealthy, but apparently these guys felt that they weren't, and they were down on their luck, and so they were dumb enough to think that if you kidnap kids, you'll be able to call in a ransom. But in the hour, you'll find out what happened when they tried to call in and couldn't get through.
Wow. CBS's David Begno on 48 Hours, Live to Tell the Chowchilla Kidnapping. Thanks, David.
Thank you, Steve.
You can catch 48 Hours on the CBS Television Network Saturday nights or stream it anytime on CBS All Access. Talk show host Ellen DeGeneres is speaking out about her friendship with former President George H.W. Bush.
It may not seem like a big deal for a celebrity to attend a football game, but I never leave my house, so it is a big deal.
Ellen and her wife, Portia de Rossi, were invited to sit in the private box of Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones. Former President George W. Bush and his wife, Laura, were also there.
But during the game, they showed a shot of George and me laughing together, and so... people were upset. They thought, why is a gay Hollywood liberal sitting next to a conservative Republican president? Didn't even notice I'm holding the brand new iPhone 11. And, but a lot of people were mad, and they did what people do when they're mad. They tweet. And but here's one tweet that I loved. This person says, Ellen and George Bush together makes me have faith in America again. And,
but instead of getting into the fray on social media, Ellen used the moment to preach about civility.
Here's the thing. I'm friends with George Bush. In fact, I'm friends with a lot of people who don't share the same beliefs that I have. We're all different, and I think that we've forgotten that that's okay that we're all different. When I say be kind to one another, I don't mean only the people that think the same way that you do. I mean be kind to everyone. Doesn't matter.
Nora O'Donnell with Ellen's message of friendship transcending politics. Harry Styles opening up in a new song.
The former One Directioner has dropped a new song, Lights Up, ahead of his second solo album. Styles tells Rolling Stone it's all about having sex and feeling sad. He says he did a lot of mushrooms with his band between recording sessions in Malibu. The video for Lights Up features Styles shirtless, grinding and dancing with a pack of sweaty, barely clothed people. Deborah Rodriguez, CBS News.
The WNBA Finals went down to the wire.
The WNBA title now resides in D.C.
2019 WNBA champions.
The Washington Mystics were crowned champs for the first time in a deciding game, 89-78 win over the Connecticut Sun. Banged up Mystics star and league MVP Elena Deladon led the comeback on ESPN.
Deladon cutting through two, gets it to go on the foul.
Battling a bad back, wearing a knee brace and a face mask to protect a broken nose, she scored 21 points. Steve Kathan, CBS News.
Finally this weekend, from the football field to the doctor's office, one running back is helping women get the health care they need.
Former NFLer D'Angelo Williams originally chose to pay for 53 mammograms because his mom was 53 years old when she died in 2006. His foundation, called 53 Strong for Sandra, started out in 2015 by holding mammogram screening events for underinsured women in Charlotte, North Carolina. Now his foundation says in 5 years, he's sponsored more than 500 mammograms. The foundation has expanded its screening events to more states and hopes to hit all 50. And it hits home for the former running back for the Panthers and Steelers. Not only did his mom die of breast cancer, but all four of her sisters died from it too. Matt Piper, CBS News.
That does it for the weekend roundup. Thanks for listening. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. John Whitley is the technical supervisor. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.